south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let's start off today with an email that seems off topic, but it really isn't. This one's from George in New Jersey. He says, Johnny, you talk about Latinos putting on the dog. Funny, you should use that term. I had an uncle who used it all the time. Anyway, he says, if you think Latinos put on the dog, well, I know lots and lots of gringos who do. It's a stupid and bad habit, I know. Especially if you're used to having wealthy friends or acquaintances who could buy and sell those people, yet they lay low and never show off their wealth. He says, I know a thing or two about it. I'm middle class, solid middle class, but I went to Brown University, an Ivy League school. My parents weren't rich at all, but I got a scholarship, luckily. Could never have afforded it otherwise. It's something like 50 grand a year. He says 90% of the kids who went to Brown had parents who were ungodly wealthy. A different sort of people altogether. Not bad people, just living in a different reality from what I was used to. By the way, the other 10% of kids going to Brown were scholarship kids like me, or diversity or affirmative action kids. I guess they had to do it back then. That was slightly before the wokeness thing got started. Anyway, here's what I learned about putting on the dog in my 4 years at Brown. My rich kid buddies with old money wore very nice clothing all the time, even pajamas and socks. Most all had live-in maids back home who actually pressed all their clothes and packed their suitcases for them. And none of it had obvious brand identification. In fact, they used to snicker at people wearing high-end logos like Gucci and Prada. They'd say, oh, that's for absolute suckers. And reality show addicts. Man, I learned a lot about class distinctions from having a few Brown University friends who were trust fund babies with parents in the nine-figure range. Yep, they had very nice clothes, but very few famous logos. Oh, and my trust fund buddies never worked summer jobs. They'd spend the summer traveling. But I worked. I had to. I used to work summers doing grunt work for a carpenter who did high-end kitchen remodeling in neighborhoods so rich, their kids all went to Ivy League schools. It was certainly different spending all day in a rich person's kitchen that was practically bigger than my parents' house. You know what, Johnny? I never caught any of those people wearing clothes covered with logos or Gucci signs. Even at 8 in the morning, if they weren't dressed in a suit for work, they wore solid, colored t-shirts and khakis or jeans, and nice but not logo-plastered running outfits or running shoes. And the youngsters and teenage kids of these ultra-wealthy families did not have green or blue hair or nose or eyelid piercings. Oh, and about these kids with parents who were mega-wealthy, they never bragged about it. I personally watched my Brown University mega-wealthy buddies stay absolutely quiet about it. Maybe it was just the kids of the mega-wealthy, but they had a different attitude about it. For example, when we went out to eat or to a Starbucks, they never balked when presented with a bill. In fact, they never scrutinized a bill like me and my middle-class buddies would do. Man, I can't tell you how many times I've questioned a bill, but not my mega-wealthy buddies. Oh, and my trust fund buddies weren't nuts about fantasy football or baseball. They followed sports, but never fanatically. But man, did they have expensive hobbies, the kind that you and me would never have, or even have the faintest idea of the actual rules of the game. Like sailing, polo, rugby, rowing, lacrosse, sports that were totally foreign to me. And man, if you live in New Jersey and your buddy's got 7 surfboards, you know his folks are not just rich, they're mega wealthy. Speaking of putting on the dog, what would you think of a guy who bragged about visiting at least 5 countries, all that by the time he even graduated from high school? For a middle-class kid, that'd be something to brag about. But my rich buddies, they'd all been to Europe by the time they graduated high school, but none of them ever talked about it. No bragging, no nothing. Just something you did with your parents once or twice a year. And Johnny, visiting my rich buddies' houses sort of made me feel funny. They always had a grand piano or a cello in its own particular corner or even its own music room. And sometimes someone would actually be playing one of those things quite well, too. Another amazing and strange thing is their houses seem to have no clutter. Always a 50-ish maid around, too, in uniform. I don't know why, Johnny, but many rich people who could afford anything like their homes to be very simply furnished, simple aesthetics, which honestly doesn't feel quite homey or comfortable to me. I'd feel a bit stiff when I'd sit on a sofa in my rich buddies' houses. Never could completely relax. I noticed many of the parents of my buddies from Brown had very few things in the house, but what they did have was very expensive. Full leather furniture from Italy, $2,000 Bauhaus chairs, stuff like that. Oh, and I noticed there are no scuffed armchairs, scrapes on the walls behind couches, or scratched furniture. None of that lived-in look. I guess when you have real generational wealth, you don't become attached too much to your possessions. You get a dent or a scratch in a coffee table, you get rid of it and get a new one. Man, that would never happen in my parents' house. I often wondered what happened to the furniture my buddy's parents threw away. I'd love to have had a tenth of that stuff in my own apartment. Oh, and the kitchens. When I'd walk into my buddy's kitchens, it was like walking onto a cooking show. Everything was spotless and so orderly. Two sinks, two stoves, a wine cooler. They had very nice glasses, stainless steel and copper everywhere, with like zero use of cheap Teflon pans and Tupperware. Oh, and fresh flowers in the living room and in the kitchen every day. Speaking of having so much money and class you'd never have to put on the dog, that would just be way too crass. When I was at Brown rubbing shoulders with the offspring of millionaires and billionaires, something I always noticed was how certain close groups of kids would just come back from a weekend with fresh sunburns or windburn. They'd jet off on weekends to who knows where, but never bragging or even talking about it. But you could certainly tell they'd been somewhere far, far away. Yep, it didn't take me long to realize you live on a different plane when you never have to worry about money. So if you're like me and weren't born with a silver spoon, but manage to become friends with the ultra-wealthy through osmosis by having the dumb luck to be accepted into an Ivy League school like I was, if you're suddenly thrown into classes with all those guys, you can sort of get absorbed into and get accepted by that crowd, but you never really fit in. For example, you could date one of your buddy's sisters or friends or cousins. You know it's fleeting. You know it won't last because you could never afford to support her lifestyle. Funny thing, too, all my trust fund buddies had at least one normal broke friend like me. Almost always a middle-class guy like me on scholarship. They'd drag me along to events and on trips. It was a lot of fun. Weird, but fascinating. You learn seemingly useless things along the way, too. I finally learned what all those forks, knives, teacups, and glasses were for. You know, at a formal dinner. Oh, and another sign of high status and wealth is teeth. T-E-E-T-H. Yes, teeth. You can tell when someone's gone to the dentist multiple times a year their entire lives, since there are probably two. Having super white, perfect straight teeth is an expensive habit. Most of the parents in my neighborhood didn't have the money to establish that routine when their kids were young. Sure, you'd go to the dentist sometime, especially when something hurt, but our parents didn't have the money to keep it up. Yep, every single one of my college buddies had braces. The very expensive ones that get attached behind your teeth, the ones you can't see. Until I went to Brown, I didn't even know those things existed. Speaking of my wealthy buddy's kitchen, most of them had not one but two double-door commercial Sub-Zero fridges, each one worth more than my car. You open one of those fridges, it's just teeming with whole food, organic vegetables, very little junk food. No mac and cheese in their houses, for sure. Yes, my wealthier friends eat a lot differently and much more healthy than any of my regular neighborhood middle-class buddies. Oh, and you should see the clothes closets of my university trust fund buddies. I don't know where they get their clothes, but it's not anywhere where I shop. And man, even when my buddies were rumpled and had a bad night, the next morning, their clothes still look sharp. They've all got a favorite personal tailor that does alterations, too. That, I think, is the key to why their clothes fit better on them than our off-the-rack clothes fit on us. Think of how many times in your life you've been to an actual tailor. For me, it's probably two, maybe three times. It's completely different for my trust fund buddies with the hyphenated last names. When they buy off-the-rack, they never wear it home. As for their cell phone use, yes, my buddies are addicted to their devices too, but my buddies with the super rich parents somehow manage to keep an extremely low profile. They've got a very small digital footprint. I've found out that most all of them have been coached about keeping a low profile and privacy issues by the family lawyer. Even today, when I look up my rich school buddies on social media, I can find very little about them. I always wonder how they pull that off. Turns out, they actually pay people to keep information about them off the internet and out of any news publications or social media. Oh, and how about this, Johnny? The first time I went on a vacation with one of my trust fund buddies, I thought it was rather weird he didn't have any luggage when he took the flight. I thought, who travels with no luggage? I thought, was he going to buy clothes at the airport? I don't know anybody who buys clothes at the airport. Turns out many of the super affluent have multiple homes in multiple cities with separate complete wardrobes in each. So no need at all to haul baggage. That means no hanging around for an hour or so at the baggage carousel either. In fact, a couple of my wealthy buddies didn't even know how many apartments, beach houses, and summer houses their parents owned. Speaking of putting on the dog, you'd think these guys and their parents would be driving Maseratis and Lamborghinis. No way. That's for the vulgar Hollywood crowd. Keeping with that low profile, they drive cars that blend in. Nice, reliable vehicles, but nothing too flashy. Of course, they've all got a principal house, usually a really nice home, set way back from the street. Yet, they drive pretty average vehicles. I remember one of my buddy's mothers was driving a Honda CR-V. Nice car, right? But I also knew she'd just sold one of her businesses for over $100 million. She even advised me, saying that if I ever make really big money, blending in is the best bet because people get weird when they know you have money. Oh, and she said something else that struck me too. She said, even if your relatives are wealthy, never let them know how much you have. She didn't elaborate, though. I wonder what she meant by that. Anyway, there's more to George's email, but that's enough for now. Skipping to the end, he says, that's about it, Johnny. Those were things I learned along the way going to an Ivy League school as a broke scholarship kid. Bottom line, the ultra-wealthy never put on the dog. It's the almost wealthy who flaunt everything and have the look at me, I'm rich and special attitude. He says, now that 20 years have passed, I'm 40 years old. What about me? How many Gucci and Prada labels do I have hanging in my closet? Practically zero. Though I wish I could say the same thing for my daughter's closet. I think she'll learn those lessons because next year, she'll be a freshman at Brown. All right, George, thanks for that. Oh, and congratulations on your learning about all those dinnerware settings. I'm still having trouble. And you know, I totally get the fact that people who put on the dog up in the States are really just demonstrating that they're social climbing wannabes. Meanwhile, there is a small class of ultra-high earners with generational wealth whose attitude is exactly the opposite. Funny thing, though, and the difference is, down here in Latin America, there doesn't seem to be that distinction. I know lots of super wealthy people with generational wealth, too. Talking about Latinos here. But still, they and their children just love to put on the dog. In fact, you longtime listeners have heard me tell stories about bodyguards here in Latin America, a.k.a. guardaespaldas. You see them all the time. They're everywhere, at the gym, Starbucks, the Waffle House. In Latin America, the more dough and status you have, the more bodyguards you have. It's the ultimate sign of putting on the dog. Whereas up in the States and in Europe, people with generational wealth, the extremely wealthy, often have no bodyguards at all. I don't know what it is, but it seems like it's something baked into the Latin genome. The more you have, the more you show it off, even if it puts you and your family at risk of extortion or kidnapping. The incentives here are just so ass backwards, because it's also very well known and established here in Latin America that if a kid gets kidnapped, or there's some kind of major extortion or robbery going down, it's almost always, nearly 100% of the time, instigated or coordinated by one of the bodyguards. So, on the other hand, Latinos are forever stumped as to why us gringos and expats don't have bodyguards. Since they know many of us gringos and expats could buy and sell the average Latino who has a bodyguard 10 times over. You know, I've been down here a long time and I still laugh and think it's preposterous when I see a Latino with a flock of bodyguards. Crazier yet is when you see an upscale Latino driving down the street with a big black SUV full of bodyguards trailing him everywhere he goes. It's almost too ridiculous for words, but you see it all the time. I often wonder why so many Latinos with wealth or perceived wealth. How do fools like that get so far in life? Why are they so stupid as to risk their own family's security, constantly making themselves a target by putting on the dog? Of course, that thinking, that happens to others, but not to me. My bodyguards would never turn on me. They're loyal and faithful. So then what's it all about? Are they really that deficient in the self-esteem department that they have to always keep putting on the dog? It would seem they absolutely need people to be jealous and envious of them. It is sort of a sickness, really. And note that for Latinos, the ultimate status symbol is having a bodyguard. And every Latino knows firing a bodyguard is a dangerous business, too. Now, there's a real catch-22 because, you know, the bodyguard has every one of your movements down. He knows your patterns, where the valuables are, where your keys are. He knows about the mistresses, the shady deals, the movements of the wife and kids. It's an unsolvable conundrum. Why, Latin Americans with money and position, they just have to show off. They have to have bodyguards. And they pass those same foolish habits down to their kids. Yet wealthy gringos and Europeans in Latin America have not a single bodyguard. On top of that, wealthy Latinos drive big black Mercedes SUVs and Tahoes, Suburbans, Hummers, and Lamborghinis. Meanwhile, wealthy gringos and expats rarely put their wealth on display like that. They're mostly driving Hondas and Toyotas. Sounds like a genetically programmed self-esteem problem to me. Just saying. Oh, and even worse, some of those rich Latinos think they're so important. They outfit those big black Suburbans and Tahoes with a set of red and blue flashing lights that are installed under the front grille. When stuck in traffic, they'll flip a switch. The red and green lights will flash in the grille like an unmarked cop car. Naturally, people pull aside, give way, thinking it's a cop. But it's not. Just a pretentious dickhead Latino, never a lady, always a guy. Now, if you did that in the United States, you'd get pulled over and fined. They'd probably haul your car off. There are laws against having emergency lights on non-emergency vehicles. However, here in Latin America, there are no such laws. And if there are, no one knows about it. So, are you getting this? It's the ultimate demonstration of putting on the dog. A classic display of macho self-importance. Now, I gotta tell you, my Latina girlfriend, who swears she'll never go out with a Latin guy again, she tells me the average Latin American male's brain never grows beyond adolescence. A situation that gets even worse when a Latino comes into money. Which sort of sums up the problem exactly. By the way, when I see a Latino pulling that light flashing stunt in his big-ass SUV, well, guess what? I don't move. Sometimes I even slow down. But oddly enough, everyone else does. Of course, if it's a real cop car, I'll move for him. Even though Latin cops are slugs, they're never in a hurry, and probably when they flash their lights, are just on their way to McDonald's. But you never know. On the other hand, if it's any black SUV pulling that shit, it's either a faker or some pretentious dickhead politician. Either way, I won't move. But hey, that's just me. All right, moving on. I've got quite a few backpackers listening to the podcast. You might call them 3- and 4-star hotel wannabes. Think about that for a while. Because backpackers, you know, stay in really low-budget, dirtbag, $5 or $10 a night, 1-star hotels and hostels. And you know, if you sit down with a bunch of backpackers, I've done this at various low-budget restaurants. By the way, number one restaurant selection for backpackers, those cheap-ass, low-budget Chinese restaurants are their favorites. Every big Latin American city has tons of them. Even the tiniest little pueblo has a cheap-ass hole-in-the-wall Chinese restaurant or two. Backpackers have sussed all those places out. They know they can get a complete combo meal for $2 or $3. Of course, that's where good old Montezuma likes to hang out, too, so I personally will have a cup of tea, but not much else. Anyway, when you're sitting around with a bunch of backpackers and you ask the question, what are the downsides of backpacking? What are the inconveniences? Things you can't much control that could wreck your trip. Well, aside from what might happen with visas and borders and airport crap, that stuff you can never predict. Aside from that stuff, as it turns out, at least according to the surveys that I've done, a backpacker's three worst enemies are, number one, Montezuma. Number two, the shared bathroom situation. Sometimes it's just fine, sometimes it's just terrible. You never know. The shared bathroom situation can be extra problematic after a weekend or a big party night. Then there's backpacker enemy number three. Take a guess. Time's up. Bed bugs. Yeah, well, you may have never had a run-in with bedbugs yourself. If you've been a backpacker, you probably have. And it seems, according to many articles written recently, bedbugs seem to be spreading and causing problems like never before. In fact, Orkin, you may have heard of them, Orkin, you know, that famous bug extermination company up in the States. You've probably seen their trucks and ads and TV commercials. Anyway, what you probably never knew, I didn't know it till I read about it, but Orkin has a website called the Bed Bug Registry. They've collected about 20,000 reports of bed bugs throughout the United States and Canada. The website highlights bed bug reports at over 12,000 locations. That's 12,000 hotels, motels, and Airbnbs. If you want to look it up, just look up bed bug reports. Anyway, unfortunately, they have no international listings. It's just in the States and Canada. And looking at the site right now, it says Chicago, New York, and Philadelphia top Orkin's 50 bed bugs big city list. That's three cities, Chicago, New York, and Philadelphia. Top the list. It's up to date, too. It's a January 2024 ranking of the metro cities with the most bed bugs. By the way, the site says when visiting any hotel, when you walk through the door, they recommend an immediate check of mattresses, box springs, headboards, footboards, bed frames, and furniture within 5 to 8 feet of the bed itself. Keep an eye out. Look for little clusters of dark brown or black spots that look like rust stains. They're actually dried bed bug excrement. Yuck. And it says as far as bacteria and generally unhygienic surfaces in hotels and Airbnbs, etc., it says steer clear of the hotel-provided TV remotes and uncovered glassware. And here's why. It says the same rag the maid uses to clean the sink and the toilet is usually the same rag they use to wipe down those other surfaces. And it says, according to a 2024 study of the University of Houston, they found that TV remotes are the most bacteria-laden items in a hotel room. Second on that list are bedside lamp switches. So then how are you supposed to change the channel on the TV? Well, the smart thing is to take a couple of Ziploc bags in your luggage. I always do that. I've got 3 or 4 of them. Rubber bands, too. They come in really handy. Just drop that remote into a Ziploc bag and you're off to the races. So you should also have some alcohol wipes in your luggage. Not to be too anal about it, but you might want to use an alcohol wipe to give the doorknobs and the light switches a wipe down when you first walk into the room. Then again, if you're of the mind to build up immunity to such bacteria, then when you walk into your hotel room, just grab that remote and give it a lick. Yum, yum. It also says here, recent research has reported startling amounts of bacteria on housekeeping supplies such as sponges and mops. So after your maid hits the room, you might want to pull out those alcohol wipes and do a once-over. Now, if you're constantly worried or finicky about that kind of stuff, just don't travel. Or you could just get yourself bubble wrapped and hang out on the sofa in your parents' basement. I hear that's pretty popular these days. But seriously, because I'm a longtime traveler myself, I've kind of developed my own streamlined system when I walk into a hotel room or rent an Airbnb, whatever. Oh, and I've rented lots of furnished apartments, too. You know, OPF, other people's furniture. I've stayed in Airbnbs for months at a time as well. That said, and in the interest of basic hygiene, just a little hint on what I've been doing for a long, long time. If I'm staying at an Airbnb or renting a place that's furnished, I look at the photos online and check out the bed. And guess what? It's almost always queen-sized. Well, let me tell you one of the best investments I've ever made. It's a queen-sized zippered mattress cover. I've done a lot of research on these things, and I bought one called the Hospitality Products Mattress Encasement. It's a zippered, bedbug-proof, dust-mite-proof, hypoallergenic sleep defense system. That's what they call it. That's what it says on the box, anyway. It's stretchable, fits any queen-sized bed, and of course, I've got a king size around here someplace too, though I've found I never have to haul it around, just the queen. By the way, it's very small and compact, has its own little plastic pouch. Got it on Amazon a couple of years back for $40. And you know, it really does give you peace of mind. If you want to know exactly which one I'm using, which one I ordered from Amazon, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Oh, and don't forget the pillows. Do you really want to put your head on a pillow that hundreds of other people have been drooling on? Personally, I don't want to think about that. So I ordered from the same company, Sleep Defense System, a pillow encasement that's exactly what the doctor ordered. It's a zippered bed bug proof, dust mite proof, and hypoallergenic sleep defense system. That's what they call it. Mighty small and compact too. You get two in a set for $20. As mentioned, if you want to know exactly what I ordered from Amazon, send me an email, theexpertfiles@gmail.com. I don't make a cent off of this, by the way. All I know is that these things give me great peace of mind and I sleep like a baby. Now, of course, if I'm staying just a few days at a nice hotel, I don't haul these things around with me. It's only when I'm renting a place furnished or in an Airbnb. I know. Some of you are thinking, "Net Johnny, he's pretty anal about these things." Well, I know some people who not only carry around a pillow and mattress encasement set, they carry around a set of sheets and their own pillowcases, too. Well, you know, I don't do that because I stay at fairly good hotels, 3 stars and up. But if I was on a low budget and stayed at nothing but 1- and 2-star hotels, or if I was a backpacker, people might say I was nuts, but I'd haul around a set of my own sheets and pillowcases, too. That said, just one more comment about backpackers. You know, as for me, I've been living so many years off the gringo tourist trail, where, of course, you hardly see any gringo tourists at all. But the ones you do see are mostly backpackers. And why not? That's where things are the cheapest, off the gringo tourist trail. And that's where a lot of the free action is for backpackers, too. Hiking trails, pyramids, volcanoes, river rafting. And, you know, one of the things that kept reinforcing in me the idea that I'd never want to be a backpacker is when I'd sit down close to a bunch of these guys in a restaurant or whatever. You know, they almost always wear shorts, and I'd notice their legs would be all bitten up. Sometimes there'd be telltale signs of dozens of insect bites and welts. And I guess after a while you get used to it. Maybe. But all the while I'm thinking to myself, are we having fun yet? Because, you know, when I get just one bug bite, it drives me nuts. I can hardly imagine nursing a dozen or even a half dozen of those things and somehow still think I'm having a good time. Especially, you know, these days there are lots and lots of tree-hugging backpackers who absolutely refuse to use any bug spray or insect repellent. Yep, we know it's harmful to humans and the environment and all that. Yeah, right, like a tropical fly, beetle, mosquito, millipede, whatever, sucking your blood and leaving behind a few toxins. Yeah, like, that's so much better because it's a kinder, greener alternative. Yeah, well, when I see a group of backpackers with red splotches and welts on their legs, and I see that all the time, I'm thinking, no thanks, I'll use the bug spray. Better yet, I'll spend it though and take the 3-star hotel with the AC. But that's just me.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.